guest today is Martin Harris, lecturer at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And he joins me to talk about his new book, Leatherface vs. Tricky Dick, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre as Political Satire, out now, published by Head Press. And I've left a link to the book in the description. As the title suggests, Harris looks at the connections between Toby Hooper's seminal horror masterpiece and the Watergate scandal that had such a profound impact on American politics and society. Martin, thanks very much for joining me in this episode. Do you want to start off by giving me a synopsis of your book and maybe how you got started in thinking about linking the Watergate scandal with Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. The book, it explores in great detail this idea that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original from 1974, comments on and maybe even satirizes and spoofs and makes fun of politics of the day. And we're talking about 73, 74, when the film was made and when it came out. And in particular, targets the Nixon administration and the Watergate scandal. Although we talk about other things, there's other topics that come up in the book in terms of the political issues of the day. But that's the general idea of the book, is looking at the movie as a commentary on politics, on contemporary politics. And then in the intro, I share statements by Toby Hooper, who directed, and Kim Henkel, who co-wrote the movie with Hooper, talking about Watergate being a very specific inspiration for the movie. They have some pretty tantalizing lines about that, some suggestive comments about Watergate being in their thoughts as they made the movie. And I talk about the coincidence of the timelines. The movie was actually conceived, written, shot, edited, produced, and then premieres almost coincidentally with the Watergate scandal, which begins June 72, Nixon resigns in August 74, and then the movie came out in October 74. So I talk about the coincidence of the timelines. I talk about how both the movie and the scandal are kind of like nightmares. They were experienced by those first audiences and the, you know, Americans during that period as a kind of nightmare that was going on, and all these great sort of connections. Watergate, you know, with its Saturday Night Massacre, and the White House horrors, and Creep, the re-election committee, and so forth. There's all kinds of sort of horror-like imagery and vocabulary associated with the Watergate scandal. So I lay all that out in the intro, and then in the book, I go through the movie actually minute by minute and use things that we see on the screen as inspiration to talk about politics of the day. And in some cases, the allusions are they seem pretty deliberate and explicit. In some cases, I kind of give myself a little bit of leeway and take something that's happening in the movie as an excuse to kind of digress into some of the political issues of the day. But that's what the book is about. That's how it's all put together and laid out.
Yeah, so this is the maybe the difficult question. So for just mainly for British readers, really. So obviously we have an understanding of what Watergate is. Some people, British listeners, I should say, not readers, we've got an understanding of what Watergate is. There's the film All the President's Men. And you see anybody who knows anything about cinema of the 70s, particularly American cinema of the 70s, the Watergate scandal comes up as a talking point quite often, in the same way as things like the Vietnam War do as well, right? Mm-hmm. As a backdrop for the kind of social political backdrop of something that's happening. But can you just explain briefly, if it's possible to explain briefly, what the Watergate scandal was, just in case people aren't as familiar with the history as you?
Yes, certainly. And in fact, I'll say one of the inspirations of the book, besides sort of having this idea that the movie, which I've been fascinated with for a long time, I've written about other horror films and I've always wanted to write about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And so I had this idea that I wanted to explore the movie's political commentary. But I was also inspired by my own interest in Watergate and Richard Nixon. That's something I've been sort of working on for many years. And also to share Watergate with readers. I teach a class, actually, and we might talk about this later, but I teach a class about Richard Nixon in the American Studies program at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And so I'm teaching a lot of young people about Nixon. And then we end the course with Watergate. And I'm explaining and I'm sharing this scandal with my students. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in the book. I think if you read the book, you'll learn a lot about Watergate and you'll find out what it's all about. And it's maybe a fun introduction to that scandal. Hugely complicated scandal that ended Nixon's presidency. It began with this break-in of the Watergate Hotel where the Democratic National Committee headquarters was in June 1972. And as it turned out, was revealed later, it was one of many kind of operations that were endorsed by, in varying degrees, by the Nixon administration and by his reelection campaign, the committee that they put together for 1972. He had served almost a full term and was up for reelection at the end of 1972. And so they're out gathering information on the Democrats, Nixon being of the Republican Party. And so there's a break-in and arrests, and then the links between the burglars and the reelection committee and others higher up in Nixon's administration, and maybe as high as Nixon himself, begin to become revealed. They're mostly suppressed through the election, and so Nixon is safely reelected by a wide margin, actually. But in early 73, the stories start to blossom. The trials of the burglars help facilitate this. And so that led to the creation of a committee by the Senate Watergate Committee, and they began having hearings in May 1973 that were televised and brought lots of attention to the scandal. And this rolled on through 1973 into 1974 with the pressures on the Nixon administration and on Nixon himself growing as time progressed. It took a long time to develop, but by the end of 1973, talk of impeachment was already out there. The possibility that Nixon was involved with all of this, these shenanigans that compromised the 1972 presidential election. The committee finished its work and produced a report. And then it took until the spring and early summer of 1974 before articles of impeachment began to be suggested. And a committee one committee did pass some articles of impeachment in the House. Then they went through that process, something that we became more familiar with recently with Donald Trump and his multiple impeachments. But the House did pass. This committee passed three articles, sent it to the full House. Before the full House could vote on it, Nixon resigned because it was fairly clear that he was going to, not only was the House going to impeach him, but then the Senate, who would then conduct a trial, would probably convict him and he would be removed from office. And so to forego that in August 1974, Nixon resigned. And so all that was playing out as Texas Chainsaw was being conceived and shot and produced, and it premiered shortly after Nixon resigned and then was pardoned by his successor, Gerald Ford.
Thank you. I mean, it's an extraordinary book in some respects, your book. I don't think I've ever read a book that has been so in depth, almost moment by moment, on a particular film, especially not linking it to a particular event. I know there's multiple different events within Watergate, right? But it's a really tight, close analysis. Before we get into going by these moment by moment scenes related to these moments that happened in the Watergate scandal, was there any elements of the book that you had to cut down? Did you have to trim any of it to make it a manageable length? Or were you stretching a bit for some of the connections? How easily did the connections come to you between the moments that happened in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like whirling the chainsaw or one of the characters being placed on a hook, and the events of the scandal?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I really didn't have to cut too much or add too much or try to, you know, it sort of came about organically. And I think the book, the detail and how comprehensive the analysis is all sort of flowed in a certain way. And so I'm pretty happy with how all that came out. I definitely was inspired to begin the project by certain moments in the film. One is at the very opening of the film, when we first look, those who have seen the film know all these moments very well, but as we look at that image of the corpses being that are sort of arranged in this sort of weird grisly work of art, they call it, in the graveyard, and we're hearing a radio announcer, and the very first story that we hear, it's actually the first words of the film, is talking about a series of indictments and a grand jury investigation and things like this. Doesn't say Nixon, doesn't say Watergate, doesn't say anything specific, but puts that idea out there right at the beginning of the film. And so a moment like that, I sort of took as further encouragement, along with Hooper and Henkel's comments, to think about Watergate as you watch this film, or think about politics as you watch this film. And then there are other moments like that. So I did write some of those as kind of in fact, when I first pitched the idea of the book, I had some of these prepared where I had picked certain moments in the film. There's one later in the film where after they've captured Sally and they're taking her into the house. And I won't go through what's happening in the plot. I'm gonna assume people maybe know what's happening in the plot, but there's an exchange between the character that's called the old man in the credits, the cook, and the hitchhiker, neither have names, when you listen to the dialogue, I thought it kind of uncannily suggests the dialogue in the Smoking Gun recording between H.R. Haldeman and Nixon, where they're talking about a crime that's happened and the idea of covering it up and so forth. And some of those comments kind of suggest that. And so I was like, okay, this is great. I can maybe, that can be something I can talk about. And then as I went through the film, I had, like I said, I had some other moments like that in mind, but going through the film with this really admittedly narrow focus, you know, I'm going to, you know, look at the film in this very peculiar way, really. Suddenly other things emerge, you know, you start to see different things. And some of them, like I say, seem to be pretty explicit, where the filmmakers were alluding to Watergate, others maybe less so, but it becomes this interesting way of watching the film and kind of pretending to be in that audience at the end of 1974, watching the film after having lived through Watergate for a couple of years and having all those things in the foreground of their thoughts, watching the film and how it suggests all of these connections. And so, yes, indeed, some are pretty explicit, some less so, but it was, in the end, it was a very fun book to write and fun to explore a couple of things that I'm very interested in anyway, this film and Watergate and Nixon.
And I suppose in that respect, you're also kind of weaving in and out of what Toby Hooper's and Kim Henkel's initial visions are, and that some of their allusions to Watergate are very explicit, some of them maybe not so, some of them self-conscious, some of them not self-conscious, and you're kind of weaving in and out of these deliberate references and the ones that maybe just came to them accidentally or by happenstance or just happened to be really fun coincidences, I suppose.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, and I talk about this in the introduction a little bit, and then I now and then bring it up in the body of the book, how I think some of it is kind of tongue-in-cheek when they talk about Watergate being an inspiration for this movie. I think certainly Hooper, if you sort of know his other films and you know what he said about movie making, generally speaking, he's always very conscious of historical context, political contexts, and is interested in that sort of thing. And when he says that the film was inspired by Watergate, I think he's being genuine. I think he's also maybe enjoyed people finding all these subtexts for his movies and did nothing to discourage that kind of approach. And so people obviously were talking about political significances and other messages in Texas Chainsaw Massacre from the very beginning, or at least shortly after the first shock of the movie, after people started to see it. And so I think sometimes, you know, there's people talk about other meanings of the movie, like it's a pro-vegetarian movie, right? And then Hooper would throw out a quote like, it's a film about meat, and would endorse that idea that the movie is anti-meat, or that, and that, and he tells stories about not being able to eat meat while they were making this film, and so forth. And I think he encouraged all of those things. And I think, like I say, there's a bit of tongue in cheek there, but that's why I described the film as a satire, or that it was taking a satirical, even comedic approach. And of course, Henkel and Hooper also talked about the comedy in the film, which maybe not initial audiences didn't appreciate, or you have to have a certain dark sense of humor to appreciate. But I think there is kind of a bit of a poking fun, and it's a serious movie, and it's obviously a very intense movie, but these messages, the political commentary, I think some of that is being done in an almost comedic way.
Yeah, and obviously there's also that kind of EC Comics kind of inspiration for the story as well, and for the kind of general tone of the film as well. And I think you mentioned it in the book as well, Robin Wood's analysis of Texas Chainsaw Massacre in his book, and how important that was to analysing the film as regards kind of social political allegory. But you also, it's a really good quote you've got from Hooper in the book as well, when he talks about film as being an osmosis of the times, and that it's always going to be reflecting the time that it was made anyway, right? So it's something that he's obviously, he understands that that's something that happens naturally, as well as then he can also play around with those ideas and have a little bit of fun with the satire as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask you a question about, so the first chapter struck me, when you move straight into analysing the film, you talk about the word vortex right at the start of the book and of the film. So do you want to explain a little bit about that, and just so the listeners get an understanding of how deep you go into the connections between Watergate and Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Yeah, I had this challenge with this book because I wanted to present the story of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm doing an analysis of the film, so I feel obligated to talk about the making of the film and the context for the making of the film, and you know, the background, and there's a very interesting backstory to Texas Chainsaw Massacre regarding the production of the film, the distribution deals that were made, how the filmmakers didn't make any money at all, and then had to fight vociferously to try to win any money from these bad deals that they had when the film was made. And so I want to tell all of that. And then with Watergate too, I want to give the reader a chance to kind of understand Watergate. And so I have to, especially in the early part of the book, I'd say the first third or first half of the book, I'm filling in some of the background as I'm marching through the minute by minute discussion of the film. And so I start right there at the beginning, the very first thing you see on the screen where we see the reference to the Vortex, which was the name of the production company that Henkel and Hooper put together. And they were actually president and vice president of this Vortex Inc. That was the company that they created to raise money to make the film. And that would also be in charge of distributing any profits that maybe potentially came from the film. And so I tell that story, and I share the gruesome details of these horrible deals that they had, and how, you know, people, this movie comes out and is seemingly making hundreds of thousands and even millions. And then the people who made the movie aren't sharing in those riches. I tell that story. And then this is a good example of me maybe taking a bit of a liberty, but I talk about Vortex being this interesting name for the company, sort of describing it, giving you the idea of kind of a black hole where things are going down. And that seems to be where all the money went from the filmmakers' perspectives. But it was a word that was used a lot to describe the Watergate scandal being this growing vortex, and everybody sort of who's involved getting affected and dragged down together into this vortex. And I refer to some headlines using the word vortex and so forth. And then I draw, actually in that opening section, I draw another literal connection between Watergate and the movie, where this distributing company was the same group that was associated with Deep Throat from a couple of years ago, the film, which actually premiered a few days before the Watergate break-in or the arrests. In June 1972, Deep Throat, of course, the notorious hardcore pornographic film that made millions. And Deep Throat, of course, becomes a part of the Watergate story as the name of the source that was used, the Washington Post, Woodward and Bernstein in their articles, Deep Throat, who was later revealed to be the assistant director of the FBI, Mark Felt. So anyway, that was kind of fun to sort of begin to make some connections, some literal, some maybe a little less explicit, but right off the bat. And that was part of my effort to start giving background to both the film and the scandal.
And similarly, the word massacre crops up in those early chapters as well, when you draw connections between the Saturday night massacre of the phrase used to describe one aspect of the Watergate events and obviously the title of the film. Can you talk a little bit about the Saturday Night Massacre, what that's referring to in relation to Watergate?
Yeah, and that's a very important moment in the Watergate scandal. October 20th, 1973, the Saturday Night Massacre, after which the talk of impeachment became much more real. And that was the Saturday Night Massacre referred to. Essentially, Nixon was in a battle over these tapes, the recordings, the secret White House recordings made in other places, and including the White House. This system that Nixon had installed in 1971 that recorded every conversation that he had, and that suddenly became revealed during those Senate Watergate hearings in July 1973. It became public knowledge. And then there ensued this great battle to get the tapes. And so the special prosecutor that was assigned, Archibald Cox, he was fighting to get hold of some of these tapes. Nixon and his men were trying to prevent their release. And they proposed a compromise where they would give transcripts or just have, you know, let someone listen and summarize them and things like that. Cox held his ground. And so finally it reached a boiling point where Nixon ordered his firing Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor. He ordered his attorney general, Elliot Richardson, to fire Cox. And Richardson refused to do so, having promised the Congress that he wouldn't do that when he was appointed attorney general. And so he resigned. His assistant, Attorney General, also resigned, and then it went down to this Solicitor General, Robert Bork, who finally did fire Cox. And so anyway, you have all of these top-level people being removed, and it was described right away as this bloody massacre. That imagery was used right away, and the phrase came up in the first reporting on it, the Saturday Night Massacre. And so I do this early in the book. I talk about that, and then I talk about how they came up with the name, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for the film. And I entertain the idea, but I dismiss it somewhat that the movie was named after this Saturday Night Massacre. It's not really, it's sort of a coincidence, essentially. But I do talk about the political significance of the word massacre and other massacres like the My Lai Massacre and the Kent State Massacre, and how the word has political meaning and is very charged. And so when you name a film Texas Chainsaw Massacre, not only do you get to enjoy the benefits of this exploitative title that might draw in some people, but you also, it fits with, if you want to make a political commentary, or if you want to make a film with some political commentary, it works in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's referring to where it just harks back to recent scandalous events in American history, or contemporary events in American history. So let's move on to some of the, so I think the listeners will want to know how you deal with the more iconographical scenes from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, of which there are many, right? So I've picked out some of my favorite moments and the moments which I think will be of most interest. So let's talk about this. You're on page 65 and you talk about the scene where they're talking about the horoscopes and the Saturn in retrograde. How do you make that connection there between that and Watergate? I'm sorry if this is coming across as a bit of a test. I'm just throwing these questions out, but I want you to kind of, expand upon it for the listeners, really, because I find it quite fascinating.
And really, this was, again, sort of, there are many things about writing this book that were fun for me. And one of the aspects of it was getting to explore these areas that I wasn't as familiar with. I knew a lot about Watergate, a lot about Nixon, a lot about horror films and this film in particular, but something like astrology in the early 1970s, that was something I got to learn more about as I wrote this. And I was made it very fun to kind of share that with the reader. And of course, fans of the film know about one of the characters in the film, Pam, who's very into astrology, and she's got her astrology book that she reads from and reads the other characters' horoscopes. And it's a nice, fun way to sort of do some foreshadowing and all these grim things in those horoscopes come true later in the film. And in fact, I talk a bit in the book about the original screenplay for the film, where there was more talk of astrology and, you know, even Saturn in retrograde, which is a phrase that Pam uses, was even entertained as a title at one point. But the idea of something causing all of these things, calamities that are happening on the planet, being caused by the astrology somehow, or the sun and solar flares. And there's these connections which I think casual viewers of film maybe don't notice. But for instance, during the opening credits, they got some stock footage of these solar flares from NASA and used them during the credits. And all that is, and there's shots of the sun in the film and so forth. And the idea that these things are making people crazy and causing these things to happen, it's very, it's implied in the film. None of it is made very explicit. But in any event, I have to talk about that. I'm going through the film minute by minute in the book. And so what are we going to make of this discussion of astrology? And so I talk about astrology and its prominence in America in the early 1970s and some of these astrologers. And I talk about one in particular, this Gene Dixon, who was kind of a celebrity astrologer and was writing best-selling books and actually had kind of a path into the Oval Office via Rosemary Woods, Richard Nixon's secretary, who was friends with this astrologer, this famous astrologer. And she would give Rosemary sort of messages about things that were going to happen based on what the stars were saying. And she would deliver them to Nixon. And in fact, she even had a meeting with Nixon at one point. And I talk about, you know, how there's even some policy that came about that was influenced by this. And so in the movie, we have a character kind of being made fun of a little bit by the other characters for believing astrology is sort of influencing what's going to happen to them. But that was the world. And that actually, I think that's a fun part of the book that helps present what life was like in 1973, 1974 in America, and astrology being very prominent in that time. It kind of waned in influence since. I think it's come back lately, but in any case, that was fun to do.
So the next section is Leatherface's first appearance. You know, again, one of the most famous scenes from the film, where he just appears almost from out of nowhere, from behind the door, hits somebody with a sledgehammer, drags the body through, and then slams the door shut. A very, very sudden appearance. What do you say about that? I know you talk a little bit about Leatherface's appearance in terms of the suit and tie, and the end of the book, the very end of the book, you draw a graphic match with some stills of a picture of Nixon with his hands in the air, alongside the picture of Leatherface with he's holding the chainsaw, but I think you've cut the image of the chainsaw off the picture, so it looks like he's holding his hands in the air in a similar pose. So you draw all sorts of resemblances between the two characters, if I can call Nixon a character. So how do you discuss Leatherface's first appearance in the book?
Yeah, that's one thing, like, in the introduction, I explain how the film is not a direct allegory of Watergate. I don't want to go down that road too much, although I do suggest that the victims in the film and the villains, the family, we could assign sort of the significance of both groups to Nixon and his men and the administration, this corrupt and criminal group being like the villains, and that they're terrorizing the American public, which would be identified with the victims in the film. So there is that going on. And I kind of go back and I go into that, go in and out of that as the book goes, not tracing a specific allegory. But one of the ideas that emerges, and I'll admit, I didn't necessarily think of this when I first started the book, but as I got into it, it seemed more and more obvious that Leatherface could be identified with Nixon in various ways. He's the one who's doing all the killing, he's committing the crimes, and then the others are kind of his co-conspirators who are helping cover up the crimes and so forth. And so he's kind of at the center of it. And so I do end up identifying, talking about Leatherface and comparing him to Nixon quite a bit in the book. And his first appearance, where he surprisingly comes out and has the sledgehammer and takes out Kirk in a couple of blows, very quickly, we see this strange man with a mask, and he's wearing a tie, and he's weirdly formally dressed as he's committing murder. And so in that, as I talk about that scene, I talk about Nixon, who always appeared in a tie and who was also sort of extreme in the way he adopted this formal image at all times, even at home, relaxing and so forth, he would wear a tie. And so that was, you know, that's the beginning of the link between Leatherface and Nixon. But then it goes further. And I think probably the place where it's most meaningful comes later in the book, where I talk about the masks and the different masks that Leatherface wears, and the Nixon mask. So I'm talking about the literal mask that first debuted at the 1969 inauguration of Nixon, and became kind of a pop culture phenomena, this Nixon mask, being symbolic or a commentary on Nixon himself being all image, there's nothing underneath, that he's this entirely political figure, and that even though he's not wearing a mask, he's got a mask on at all times. And so that's, I think, probably the most relevant connection between Leatherface and Nixon is the idea of the mask. Where Leatherface, I mean, his name is a mask. He's not even a real, you know, there's nothing there besides the masks that he wears. And so he adopts these roles in a similar way to the way Nixon would do to appease voters or gain support.
Did any of the presidents around that time have a similar, were similar criticisms leveled at them? Doesn't have to be around that time. I mean, all I'm thinking of is the film Point Break, where the, I don't know if you've seen that film, but the bank robbers, they're called the Dead Presidents, are they? Have I made that up? There's a film called Dead Presidents as well, which is confusing me. So and they put the like the Reagan mask on and the Nixon mask on to go and to run rob banks. Was Nixon the first one to have this kind of mask caricature of him that people adopted to satirize him?
I don't think so. I think he was it obviously is the most popular one. When people think of presidents and masks, that the Nixon mask is at the front of that list. In that section, that's actually probably the longest section in the book. It comes later in the book. I kind of go through the whole history of the Nixon mask, and I talk about sort of everything that came before when Texas Chainsaw Massacre appeared, and then I talk about it afterwards. And I even mentioned that movie and that example of the Nixon mask coming up in different movies and comic books and all these different places. The earliest example of the Nixon mask in a film that I'm aware of, it came before Watergate. And there was a film that included the mask, and actually characters wearing masks of different political figures. So Nixon was one, and then there were others at the time. There was a George Wallace and a LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson mask and so forth. And so I think it wasn't necessarily a new thing altogether when the Nixon mask appeared, but it took on a much more serious and grim significance. And that's the point that I make in that section, is that the Nixon mask, now we laugh at it. Now we see, you know, it's an instant bit of humor to identify a character as a villain, or he's about to rob a bank or whatever. And he puts on the Nixon mask and we laugh. At the time, it wasn't necessarily meant to be so funny, but it was a real, genuine criticism of Nixon, which I think is like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's like films and comedy albums and other satires of the day that targeted Nixon. That's what the mask was about.
I've got a few questions when I want to talk, broaden the topic out a little bit, only a little bit. But before that, can we just talk about this scene where the character of Sally is placed on the hook, which might be the most notorious scene of the film? How do you discuss that in relation to Watergate and the kind of horror of that scene? Because you allude to something quite interesting in the book, how people say that that was the most violent or the most gory scene in the film, and people imagining that they've seen a lot of more gore than you actually physically see in that movie. So how do you discuss that scene, the scene where she's placed on the hook?
Yeah, and that's actually Pam is the character who is
Pam
killed in that scene.
Yes. Yeah, not Sally, Pam, I meant to say, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like you say, quite shocking. And even those of us who've seen the movie many, many times, it still makes you wince to watch this scene. And so I discuss it in detail. I talk a bit about how it's put together and the different shots and how, in fact, we're being quite manipulated as viewers in the way that it's edited. And it's almost like a magic trick where we sort of, things are suggested to us so vividly, but not shown as she's taken in there. We've seen her bare back and we see the hook, and then we see, you know, this horrible, horrific thing occur. And so I describe all of that. And then I talk about the significance of that scene for initial viewers of the film, and how it, for many, it became the filmmakers described it as the walking scene. That was the one where people who were watching the movie would walk out of the theater. That would be like, okay, I've had enough here. It's about not even 40 minutes in, not quite halfway into the film. They say, okay, that's enough for me. But then for those who stick around, it becomes the scene that kind of stays with you afterwards, and that you know, anyone who talks about the film, you know, it's kind of a focus of the horror and the visceral nature of the violence. And it's very important and significant in that film. And then also just, you know, beyond that film, all the films that Texas Chainsaw Massacre influenced. And I make kind of a connection with Watergate being this scandal that played out. And I talk about the recordings and how significant they were, because they made explicit all of these things that were suspected about the corruption and the criminality of Nixon and his administration. Although during the scandal, Americans did not get to hear these tapes. We reread transcripts of them in the paper. And other people listened to them. A select group of people got to hear those tapes, but they weren't being played on as they would be today, right? We would be hearing clips and sharing them on social media and so forth. That wasn't happening. And it wasn't until after Nixon was out of office that they first began to surface, only in little bits. But this idea of sort of hearing the tapes themselves became kind of the important thing that drew audiences, or drew the American public in, and which made it all very real in a sense. And so I make that connection, and I talk about, you know, the tapes being kind of a hook, talking in terms of just creating narratives and the thing that a storyteller wants to include in a story to hook the audience, using that metaphor. I talk about the tapes sort of serving that role. So that's what I talk about in that section.
Thanks. So are there any other films that came out either around that time or even later that have been compared to Watergate in an allegorical way. I know you're not using a pure allegory around Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Watergate, but what other films came out around that time that would be comparable?
Well, I do take one moment in the along the way to talk about basically other films from 1974 mostly, and to make this point that, and again, I'm kind of like giving myself some, I'm trying to support my overall argument for the book that Texas Chainsaw Massacre really does have Watergate in mind or has something to do with Watergate. And I talk about how almost every film that was coming out by 1974, which would be the point where the Watergate scandal had been around for a while, and was kind of a sequel to the credibility gap and the problems with the government surrounding Vietnam, and then going back even further to the Kennedy assassination, and all of this sort of distrust and uncertainty about our leaders and whether or not they could be trusted. As far as events of the day. And so Watergate had been around long enough that filmmakers, even if they aren't making explicitly political films, that they have Watergate in mind and that they're pointing to Watergate. And so I talk about things like The Godfather, part one of which came out before Watergate, and then the sequel came out after. And how it reflects, you know, with this crime family and the idea and reviews of The Godfather, the two parts of The Godfather actually spoke to this idea that the first film, in a way, kind of champions this crime family. And, you know, reviewers likened that to Nixon and his administration being able to survive and subsist and even thrive. And then the second film maybe suggesting kind of comeuppance or, you know, where these things aren't, you know, they can't last forever. And you know, we see sort of different things happening in the second film. But all the disaster films, if you look at a list of the top grossing films of 1974, I think Texas Chainsaw is around number 15, came out late in the year, actually, but is around number 15. But up at the top are, you know, Earthquake, The Towering Inferno, Airport 75, and all these disaster films, which obviously are reflecting the uncertainty and all of this sort of negative ideas associated with the government and so on. Towering Inferno, you know, where they're, you know, the building of this building was compromised by, you know, those in power and it caused this calamity and things like that. That, yeah, it's hard to avoid those kinds of readings into those films. And I even talk about in that section, I talk about George Lucas starting, drafting Star Wars at the time. And then later revealing that with the, you know, the Palpatine with the Emperor, he was thinking of Nixon as the villain in that saga, this science fiction saga. So anyway, it's sort of interesting to think about all of those. And I don't think anyone who wants to look at films made in 74, 75, you know, and in that time frame, I don't think you're going to be too far out in left field if you think about Watergate and Nixon as you watch those films.
So I've just got a couple of questions left, really. And again, looking at a slightly broader view, what is your opinion of the sequels to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in particular the second one? Would it be, I don't think that the sequels are as strong as the original, anywhere near as strong as the original. And would I be wrong in speculating that the possibility for that is because it's not hooked onto a solid set of political, it's not hooked onto a political satire, or it's not making comment about a particular event or series of events, that it's somehow just floating around as a sequel, unhooked to anything other than itself, really. What's your thoughts on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in particular?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. And you might be onto something there about there being kind of not so much an ethos or a particular message or something sort of holding those films together. And in fact, a lot of them really, as is the case with a lot of sequels, they're mostly the thing that is the focus of those films is the original, you know, that they're kind of commenting or they're redoing or living in the world of the original in some way and doing something. And so it has this self-reflexive kind of approach that makes it maybe harder in some cases. Any filmmaker can do, you know, a talented filmmaker can make anything of that sort of material. But a lot of times those films are just about the original or kind of attempts to redo the original without the ideas that inspired the original necessarily at the center of those films. The sequel, I should say in the book, I don't talk about the sequels much at all. I do refer to the first sequel a little bit at one point, but the sequel that came out in 1986 and which Toby Hooper directed, and which Hooper himself has said he intended to be a little more explicit about both the political messaging and the comedy. You hear that a lot in the discussion of the sequel, that it's more sort of a comedy horror film that goes over the top with the gore, you know, which is much, it's a much different approach than the first film where there's really not a lot of blood, even despite all of these sequences. And that there was a target, so for this film that came out in 1986, there was an attempt to talk about the culture of the era, the 1980s, Reaganism, yuppies, and in the opening sequence of that sequel, there's a couple of yuppies that get killed. And so it seems like that was part of the idea there, that maybe they would sort of use that as a target. And, you know, the family, I guess, has become a more of a commercial enterprise in that sequel, right, where they're selling their meat and winning contests and this kind of thing. And there's a lot of things that are interesting in that film, but I think it would be much more of a challenge to do what I did with the first film, with the second one, and to do some kind of to pull out like a coherent political commentary targeting Reagan or, you know, America of that period. And so I'm not saying it's not there though. And it's, and that film has a lot of fans, and I don't want to sort of suggest that it's not a film that doesn't have a lot of things that make it interesting and with some merit that would encourage closer readings. I'm not so sure about other sequels after that, things that have come out more recently or remakes and reboots and so forth. But that's just, you know, that's part of the story of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so it's hard to ignore it. But I kind of do in the book. I focus mainly on the early 1970s and American politics and the original film.
So what's the enduring significance then of Watergate?
I think that's a question that is, it's a very good one to ask. And I mentioned teaching this Nixon class, and one of the things that I'm trying to do with the students is to get them to appreciate just how important Watergate was, and the way that it kind of changed it along with other sort of events leading up to Watergate, changed the way that Americans view government and the distrust that was sown and which had already started to blossom by this time. Became pretty well sealed as almost a default view of many Americans who go back. You don't have to go back that far, but, you know, go back to the 50s and the trust, you know, you can see it in movies. You can see it in all sorts of media and productions of the earlier era, that the unquestioned acceptance of the government's view and the trust that Americans could have in the government looking out for their best interests was there. And then it was not. And Watergate definitely marked kind of a divide after which Americans operated very differently and believed very differently about the government. And it's the scandal itself, the resignation, and I think the pardon by Ford of Nixon, and Nixon kind of getting away with it in a literal sense, but it didn't help appease these feelings. And so that grew, and we've seen ever since continued distrust, and it's growing and growing. I've obviously, with the Donald Trump administration, and the we saw sort of events and scandals and impeachments, multiple impeachments, and things that sort of seemed to dwarf Watergate in some way, and maybe make it seem less significant from today's perspective. But I think it's foolhardy to deny the link between Watergate and where we are today, and the kind of instinctive distrust and all the divisions that we see in American and American politics. All of that going back to that time where this distrust was given, people had good reason to have distrust, and it has endorsed that view ever since, I think.
Martin, that was fantastic. Thanks very much for that conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, this is great. Love talking about all this.
That was Martin Harris discussing his new book, Leatherface vs. Tricky Dick, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre as Political Satire, now available from Head Press. And I've left a link to the book in the description. Thanks to Martin for joining me today, and thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.